Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor-Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Sean Mulville, who will be telling us a little bit about angioma. So tell me a little bit about the Angioma Alliance.
Well, Angioma Alliance Canada basically started in 2011. The American Angioma Alliance has a chat forum, which I found after I was diagnosed in 2006 with cavernous malformations. And there was a lack of Canadian representation. So in meeting a few people via the chat forums, Connie Lee, the one who started the Angioma Alliance in the United States, asked for some people to step up. One of the gentlemen, Hank, that I had met through the chat forums as well, asked if anybody would join him to form the Canadian chapter. So a few of us stepped up and we created the Angioma Alliance Canada. And we're a small group of passionate people working towards a cure. One of the biggest things that we're doing is to, just to provide awareness to people and support.
So in terms of angioma itself, how does it affect a person?
Pardon me?
How does the condition typically affect a person?
Typically, people would get seizures, headaches. Now, not everyone presents the same way. It can hemorrhage, which could cause a stroke, seizures. And the only way that it can be treated at this point is through surgery. So, anything can happen after that. Some people, when they have the cavernous malformations, when they bleed, they may need, they may have some vision problems. They may have, like I said, some major headaches, seizures. They'd have to see someone like a neurologist that would help them to help them manage their pain and their seizures.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected with this condition?
It's approximately one in every 500 people were affected. Now, in saying that, many people never have symptoms, and they're just sort of found, if they bump their head or after an accident. But some people, if they, sometimes they do go into the hospital because they've had a major headache, and then they do the MRI, and then they find out that these people have the cavernous malformations. Most people have never heard of it, like myself, until I was diagnosed myself in 2006.
So you mentioned surgery can be used to treat this. Is it typically effective?
Yeah, they wouldn't do it if it wasn't going to be. They're very cautious in whether or not they would perform surgery on someone. The big reason they would is if it is affecting their quality of life. For instance, for myself, I had one of the cavernous malformations. It was growing. It was bleeding, and so it was blocking my flow of my cerebral spinal fluid. So my head was essentially filling up with cerebral spinal fluid over the period of a year. And so they had to go and remove one of them, which was in my third ventricle. Otherwise, it would have just been blocked, and it wouldn't have turned out well for me. So they went in there, and they removed it, and I've been fine ever since.
So you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness of this condition, what would you say?
Well, one of the big things is that we want people to know that they're not alone. As I said before, many people don't know about this until they have a major event in their life or their family has a major event in their life. So one of the big things is that we want to make sure that people, first of all, get the correct knowledge and learn what it is and how it can affect you, and also know that we're here for you. If anybody needs to talk to someone, you know, about how they're feeling, or if their family wants to talk to someone about what they could look for, then you know what? The big thing is that creating awareness just helps people to be prepared. It's better to be prepared so you know, you can have an idea of when you should go seek help.
So, has there been any success moment for the Alliance that stands out for you?
Well, we've had about 7 conferences in Toronto and in Hamilton, which we got together, you know, say a group of 50 people on average. And many of these people have never spoken to someone face-to-face before with cavernous malformations. So that was, in my opinion, that's one of our success moments, is that we were able to put together a group of people. And then we had people like Dr. Brent Derry from the Sick Kids Hospital, one of the researchers there, and he addressed the crowd to teach them, show them what type of research they're doing to work towards a cure. And we also had neurosurgeons come in to talk to people about what they could expect and maybe, you know, talk them about what they're currently going through. So in saying that, the big thing is getting people together and, you know, helping each other out.
So what are the next steps going forward for the Alliance?
Well, the next step is, you know, I guess you can say one of the challenges is, as in many organizations, would be the funding. Funding would go towards, you know, keeping up the website so that we can provide patients and family with literature. We're going to put on another conference, which we do typically in the summertime, in June, so people can look out for that. And we'd like to have people having face-to-face meetings. What I would like to see is the other people in the community in Canada putting on their own meetings and, you know, just meet-up groups face-to-face to help support one another. And the major thing we would love to see would be a cure. And I know that the you know, scientific community is working on medications that would help to prevent lesions from growing, cavernous malformations from growing. So hopefully we'd like to see a cure. That's what we're looking towards.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Cam. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. This next segment of our show, we'll hear from Jack Manchester, will be telling us a little bit about mindfulness martial arts. So tell me a little bit about mindfulness martial arts.
Well, our mindfulness martial arts program is a therapeutic environment that supports young people to translate the learnings of a martial arts dojo into their everyday life. We have kids who are 12 years old to 18 years old, and they're combining martial arts training with mindfulness meditation training, yoga training, and cognitive behavioral therapy and behavioral principles.
So this would have the effect of someone with, say, a learning disability or an emotional difficulty having the benefits reaped from this?
Yes. When we have a learning disability that is complicating our existing mental health concerns, it's really important to have multiple avenues of teaching and learning available so that different brains that learn in different ways can take in these lessons in the way that best suits them. And so within our dojo, we are using not only visual cues, vocal cues, conversation, we're also teaching the lessons in a kinesthetic way. We're letting the participants learn the lessons through the use of their bodies for how do we react when threatened, how do we react when stressed, and how can we consciously account for and improve those situations when they occur for us in our day-to-day lives.
So, are there any challenges in tailoring these programs to someone with a learning disability?
Well, certainly. So, first of all, program costs are a concern. So we're really thankful to our generous supporters who continue to believe and support our mission. Families themselves take up a lot of the cost as well through a very sincere dedication to the well-being of their children. And, of course, the youth themselves are being asked to do very challenging practices, mentally and physically. If we have a learning disability that affects our ability to regulate our attention, mindfulness meditation is going to be even more challenging off the bat than it would be for the standard population, and it's already a challenging practice. And it has the potential, a meditation practice has the potential to be all the more beneficial for someone who struggles with something like attention regulation.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the program, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Trouble finding one. I've seen some pretty astonishing shifts from some really dedicated youth. We've had some students come through our program who struggle with significant mood dysregulation. So they have levels of anxiety or levels of volatile temperament that can impair their ability to function at school or to connect with peers or to get along with their families. And we have seen them face those problems week to week, head on, and undergo a shift towards being able to do things that scare them or do things that test their patience and heal broken social bonds, build new and trusting friendships with their peers, and improve their ability to manage their anxiety, manage their attention in the school setting as well, improving their grades.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for programs like this, what would you say?
Our approach to mental health interventions has to put the child's own learning profile at the center of the treatment. And so the Mindfulness Martial Arts Program supports young people, however they learn, in translating their learnings into everyday life through an engaging martial arts format.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the public about programs like this?
Yeah, we have a website, childdevelop.ca, and we use Twitter and Facebook channels as communication platforms as well. Honestly, a lot of our referrals and a good number of the current clients came to us through word of mouth or through conversation with their other community healthcare providers, doctors, other social workers, and professionals in the school.
So, do you see a very positive response from the community in general, knowing that this program exists?
We do. As far as our reputation goes within the school setting and with other professionals in mental health disciplines, we do have a very positive reputation based on the impacts that are witnessed in the students who come through our programs.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Certainly.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're hosting friends for a night in, exploring new restaurants and breweries in town, or going out to your favorite watering hole, please drink responsibly. Designate a sober driver, call a taxi, a friend, or just stay over. Thank you for always driving sober. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor-Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Don Mulville told us a little bit about angioma, and Jack Manchester told us about the benefits of mindfulness martial arts. In this segment of our show, we'll get an update from our friend Neil Boulanger, who will be telling us a little bit about the BC Aboriginal Network on Disability Society. So tell me a little bit about some of the latest happenings with BCANS.
Thanks, Cam, and thanks always for allowing us to speak on your show. So here in British Columbia, October is Registered Disability Savings Plan Awareness Month. So BCANS, with our partners, the Disability Alliance BC and Plan Institute, has been trying to raise awareness both in British Columbia and across Canada about the importance of the RDSP and the importance of getting the support to enroll in it as soon as possible for those who are eligible. And this month, we'll be hosting a small gathering at our office to continue to engage our partners, financial institutions, families, to continue to raise awareness. Because as I'm sure most of the listeners know, although a great program, it's really unsubscribed, with only about, you know, approximately 30% of those who are eligible to open an RDSP doing so. So awareness about the program is still a big priority, and we're working to get that out there. So that's something we're working on right now. As well, currently in British Columbia, the province is engaging in accessibility legislation. So the province is doing a series of community meetings across BC to engage persons living with disabilities, community members, seniors, to see what exactly the barriers that they're facing as it relates to accessibility, and what information standards should be created to ensure very comprehensive and sound accessibility legislation for the province. So BCANS sits on the advisory committee with the province, and yesterday I had the opportunity to present with Minister Simpson at the First Nations Summit to give them a brief on the legislation and how their members could contribute as well. So that was a good day. As well, of course, November is Indigenous Disability Awareness Month, and that's formally recognized by the province of British Columbia, Saskatchewan, the Assembly of First Nations, the Métis Nation BC, BC First Nations Summit, and probably about 20 nonprofit organizations across Canada. So we're continuing to spearhead that and raise awareness about Indigenous Disability Canada, because it's just not a priority now. And although we've moved the needle forward a bit, there's still a long way to go to make sure that the communities and the members that we work with are getting the proper supports and services that they require.
So, what are some of the major barriers you're hoping to overcome with the provincial legislation?
Well, I think the big thing right now is getting the voice of persons living with a disability. Of course, transportation is always an issue. Access to technology so you can contribute online, that's an issue as well. So really, you know, the legislation is going to be comprehensive, and it's going to have the teeth it needs to do some good work. It really needs to be directed influenced by the disability community. And that's not just in relation to identifying the barriers and making recommendations, but there has to be representation on whatever governance board and structure that they put in. And the majority of the people must be people who are living with a disability, and of course have representation from the Indigenous disability sector as well. So I think the biggest barrier that the province is going to face, even though they do have a lot of substantive information from the previous federal accessibility consultation with Bill C-81, they really need to make sure that there is ample opportunity and venues for all people to participate.
So have you seen a lot of community support to date for the upgrades?
Absolutely. I mean, the community and the disabled community, disability community, everybody wants this, but they want to make sure that it's something that's going to be effective and it's going to work. It's not going to work if it's just a piece of legislation that looks good on paper, or if it doesn't have the strength to make sure that there's positive change. And, of course, the legislation looks at, you know, if there's going to be monetary penalties, how will they happen, what will they be, the government's structure, as we talked about before, and what areas will we cover. So a lot of it is covered, similar to Bill C-81 at the federal side, but also, you know, our recommendations have been, of course, to look at as employment within the provincial government, to make sure that there are opportunities for persons living with a disability and carve out some of those positions, and also procurement when, you know, the government is giving contracts, major contracts to organizations and companies that they must incorporated disability lens, and they must show how they're going to do that. So I think there's a lot of work to be done, but I think generally the attitude is positive. But, you know, again, it must be directed by persons living with a disability and their families.
So if you could send any message to the community about why this matters and why the work has to keep going forward, what would you say?
I would say that, you know, there are so many barriers that that persons who live with disabilities face that we're unaware of them, right? And so depending on what type of disability a person may live with, you know, there are barriers that are specific to that. You know, we have an opportunity to sit on a number of advisory committees from CPPD to Canada Post, and I'm always impressed about how little I know about the disability sector, even though I've been working in it for 20 years, and that the barriers that I think have been addressed, such as a cut curb, actually isn't as effective as it could be, because there might be a small lip on there, which causes barriers for persons who are blind or partially visioned and not being able to see that or designate over that, and it could result in them tripping. So all those things that we take for granted, that we think, you know, has been covered, in reality, there's still a lot of barriers there. So the message I'd say is participate. Make sure your voice is heard. Make sure that you give your insight and your expertise, and that's the way that we're going to start addressing these on an ongoing basis.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you, Cam.
My pleasure. My friends, I'm pleased that Neil and BCANS are involved in some of the advocacy when it comes to just the rights of individuals with disabilities out there in BC. Truth is, no matter where we come from, what we look like, what our heritage is, how we move, how we think, how we communicate, we are all bound by a fundamental need for understanding, acceptance, and opportunity. Truth is, a person with a disability can and will achieve if they're given the right tools, the right understanding, and the right moment. There, but for the flip of any card, goes any life you can think of. Sometimes the biggest things that happen to us are just a spur of the moment, everything lining up in a particular way. Truth is, those in power need to remember that they themselves could be subject to a disability at any time. Disability doesn't care how much money you have or how much political influence. And looking at these issues, you can say this is a matter of not only accessibility, but of human dignity, equal opportunity, equal access. It's fine during an election time to go around and say, oh, I support this, I believe in this. My question is, can you prove it the next day? You make it into office. That's great. Are you going to follow through and create what you have said you are going to create? Are you going to be someone who embraces diversity for real, or just someone who panders to the crowd and says, yeah, I believe in this because it's kitsch, it's in vogue. People want to have that feeling that, ooh, I'm a supporter. I'm on your side. I mean, truth is, there are some great ones. There really are. There are people in positions of influence who really are pushing forward and paving the way. But the truth is, it's hard to set a precedent. It really is. I mean, being the first to actually embrace diversity and equality, yeah, it's hard to bust through those doors and say, we can do this. However, once those doors are open, it's that much easier for the next guy. It's so necessary, my friends, to create opportunity, to create hope. I mean, hopelessness and a feeling of isolation is one of the worst disabilities out there. And when you feel that no one's hearing your voice, no one's standing at your side, that is its own condition. And believe me, it's like climbing a mountain of sand. You may make it a few feet up, but if you feel there's no reason to keep going, you'll slide back. We as a people must never say, oh, look at the great job we've done, and leave it at that. Creating disability infrastructure comes down to monitoring and building maintenance. Just making sure everything is working the way it should be. To put it in place is fine. It's a great step, but it's not the whole show. So, one of the things I love to see is innovative ways to reach an individual with a disability. Jack Manchester shared with us a little bit about mindfulness martial arts. Now, on the surface, martial arts, just a great defensive technique. It's good to know how to protect yourself, and it has the side effect of improving focus. We all know this. But for a person with a learning disability, sometimes that's the difference between getting an education and being regarded as, quote-unquote, the problem child. Nobody needs that. I mean, if we decide to just label somebody and let them get lost in the system, that's our own doing. Yeah, it's fine for us. We just send them off, make them somebody else's problem. But for the child who has to live with that, child who has to get up every day, what do you think it means? What message does it send to them to say, oh, we don't care enough to take time to work with you with your condition? But it's programs like that that say, it's going to take a lot of patience, probably take a lot of years, but I believe you can do it, and you can progress. And in a lot of ways, improved focus and even improved physical range of any sort doesn't just change the muscle or the mind, changes the person. Once they realize impossible is merely a question of perspective in many cases, they start to think more about what they can do, as opposed to what we as a society sometimes get too comfortable telling them they can't. The truth is, opportunities are made every day, but they're not made by those who just write a check and forget the whole thing. Opportunities are made by volunteers, family members, a committed community who decides to get in there and say, this is a person, a living, breathing, potentialed human being who can reshape a landscape. And yeah, it takes an entire lifetime to shape what a person is. Who we are today is a product of how people taught us to be yesterday. If they built us up with encouragement and hope and words of love and understanding, yeah, maybe we'll wake up believing in ourselves a little more. But if they tear us down, that has the opposite effect. You carry those labels, you carry that hopelessness, and I ask the question, why? Why does anyone think they have the right to tell another human being who they can be, what they can achieve, and what tomorrow will bring? Nobody has those answers. But if we stand united as people, all people, we can pave the way to a better future, one in which no one has to go to sleep saying, my life doesn't count, and wake up saying, oh no, another day. Instead, we can have those same people go to sleep saying, I accomplished something today. I blessed a life. Wake up saying, what can I accomplish today? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.